Picture this, if you will. You're a pediatrician seeing a two-week-old female infant for her first routine visit. She's from a refugee family, and her mother has had no prenatal care. According to her mother, she's lost about 12% of her birth weight. Her parents report poor feeding, lethargy, and irritability. She vomits a little bit, but she's had very few wet or dirty diapers in the past 3 days. Vitals reveal that the patient is afebrile but tachycardic, and on physical exam, she overall appears weak and ill. Her fontanelles are sunken, and her mucosal membranes are dry. You already anticipate that this child needs to be sent to the local pediatric hospital immediately, but you remove the diaper to complete your physical examination, and notice a subtle abnormality in the child's genitalia. The labia appear abnormally fused at the base, and the urethra appears to track very close to the underside of the clitoris. What congenital disorder might explain the patient's condition? And how does that affect your initial management? And welcome back to Audio Bricks. I'm Arjun Iyer, bringing topics from endocrinology from our bricks to your ears. After completing this section, you'll be able to 1. Define congenital adrenal hyperplasia, or CAH, and list the three most common types. 2. Describe the varying clinical features of CAH and explain how they relate to hormonal abnormalities. 3. Explain the pathophysiology of CAH in terms of how steroid synthesis is altered. 4. Explain how to diagnose CAH and how to distinguish the three most common subtypes based on clinical findings and common lab tests. And 5. Outline the treatment of CAH. Part 1. What is congenital adrenal hyperplasia? Congenital adrenal hyperplasia, or CAH, is the name given to a group of disorders that cause loss of function of one of the enzymes in the cortisol synthesis pathway. They're autosomal recessive disorders that have, combined, an overall prevalence of 1 in 16,000 births, with a higher prevalence in Ashkenazi Jews and some Native Alaskan groups. Now remind me, which organ is primarily responsible for regulating cortisol synthesis? The pituitary stimulates the adrenal gland to produce cortisol via adrenocorticotropic hormone, or ACTH. And when it senses low levels of cortisol, it ramps up the production of ACTH. Now, the elevated ACTH can't actually fix the enzyme deficiency, but it attempts to partially compensate by causing hyperplasia of the adrenal gland. Now, the three most common enzyme deficiencies in the cortisol synthesis pathway are 21-hydroxylase deficiency, 11-beta-hydroxylase deficiency, and 17-alpha-hydroxylase deficiency. And here's where it gets interesting. See, the synthetic pathways of all adrenal steroids share several steps in common. Not only the glucocorticoids like cortisol, but also the mineralocorticoids like aldosterone, and the androgens like androstenedione. Now, if the deficient enzyme in cortisol synthesis is also involved in aldosterone or androgen synthesis, then those steroids will be deficient as well. But if it isn't, well, here's where things get wacky. See, the elevated levels of ACTH don't just cause hyperplasia of the cells that produce cortisol. They cause hyperplasia of the aldosterone and androgen-producing cells as well. So, if the synthesis pathway for that steroid is intact, then the hyperplasia of the adrenal cortex actually causes an excess of that hormone to be produced. Whoa, mind blown. Now, part of why CAH is such a universal part of med school curricula is because it's an important cause of childhood electrolyte and urogenital abnormalities. But another is because to understand how the different enzyme abnormalities affect the levels of mineralocorticoids, glucocorticoids, and androgens, you have to understand how the synthetic pathways of aldosterone, cortisol, and the androgens are linked. So with that in mind, let's review some physiology. Recall that there are three zones of the adrenal cortex that produce the three different types of steroids. The mineralocorticoid aldosterone is produced in the zona glomerulosa. The glucocorticoid cortisol is produced in the zona fasciculata. And the weak androgens like DHEA and androstenedione are made in the zona reticularis. From superficial to deep, that's glomerulosa, fasciculata, and reticularis, GFR, like the measure of kidney function that the adrenals are so close to. And the steroids they synthesize are aldosterone, cortisol, and the androgens. And since they're involved in the homeostasis of salt, sugar, and sex, students get a kick out of the mnemonic, the deeper you go, the sweeter it gets. And if I'm being honest, so do I. because I'm a child at heart. So, one more time, just to make sure you remember. What are the three layers of the adrenal gland from superficial to deep? GFR, glomerulosa, fasciculata, and reticularis. And what do they synthesize, my friends? Aldosterone, cortisol, and the androgens. Salt, sugar, and sex. The deeper you go, the sweeter it gets. Never gets old. Anyway, the reason that the different zones synthesize different steroids is because the different cells in each layer are equipped with a different set of enzymes in the steroid synthesis pathway. Now, I'm sure you've all seen that diagram from hell that maps out all the different enzymes and their intermediates, and before you turn this podcast off, no, I'm not literally going to read out each step for you to listen to, so just chill out for a sec. Instead, I'm going to focus on what's the most important steps towards cortisol synthesis. Because remember, congenital adrenal hyperplasia is caused by low levels of cortisol, since that's the main stimulus for the pituitary to crank up the production of ACTH. So remind me, what is the basic molecule used to synthesize cortisol and all the steroid hormones? Cholesterol, right? And here's the simplified version as it pertains to cortisol. Cholesterol is converted to pregnenolone, which then becomes progesterone. And for the purposes of CAH, conceptualize this as the first branch point in steroid synthesis, dependent on the presence of the enzyme 17-alpha-hydroxylase. If you have this enzyme, then you can convert progesterone to 17-hydroxyprogesterone, which can make cortisol or the adrenal androgens. If you don't have it, then you're stuck with regular old progesterone, which makes only aldosterone. Super, super important, so I'll repeat it. If you have 17-alpha-hydroxylase, you can make cortisol and the adrenal androgens. If you don't, you can only make aldosterone. And the presence of 17-alpha-hydroxylase is usually what distinguishes the cells of the fasciculata layer from the cells of the glomerulosa layer. Next super important point. The next two enzymes that synthesize aldosterone and cortisol are the same. No, really. First is 21-hydroxylase, and the next is 11-beta-hydroxylase. The alphas and betas aren't that important, nor are the names of the intermediates. Just remember the order 21, then 11. If you started with progesterone, then 21 and 11 will give you aldosterone. But if you started with 17-hydroxyprogesterone, then 21 and 11 will give you cortisol. The next branch point of steroid synthesis is the enzyme 21-hydroxylase. If you have number 21 then, like we said, you can make both aldosterone and cortisol, depending on what molecule you start with. Now if you don't have 21, well, assuming you passed your first branch point, then you can only make androgens. This is branch point number 2, and just to make sure you're getting this all, let me quickly review the path from progesterone to cortisol. Okay, so you need 17, then 21, then 11 hydroxylase to make cortisol, and each one serves as a branch point in which steroids you can make. So what are the enzymes and possible steroid fates of branch point 1? Branch point 1. If you have number 17, you can make cortisol and androgens. If you don't, you can only make aldosterone. And what are the enzymes and steroid fates of branch point 2? Branch point 2. If you have number 21, you can make aldosterone and cortisol. If you don't, you can only make weak androgens. The branch point at the final enzyme, or 11-beta-hydroxylase, is kind of weird. Now, you might assume that since 11 is also a step in both aldosterone and cortisol synthesis, that this branch point is pretty much the same as the last branch point at number 21. But it's not. See, turns out a lot of those almost aldosterone and almost cortisol precursors do have weak activity. But both the aldosterone and cortisol precursors have weak mineralocorticoid activity. Weird. Until you see a diagram of these molecules and see that the steroids all pretty much look exactly the same. So, branch point number 3. If you have 11-beta-hydroxylase, like with 21, you can make cortisol and aldosterone. If not, you can make androgens, like with a 21 deficiency, and weak mineralocorticoids. Basically, off-brand aldosterone. Alright, let's review the branch points one last time. What are the three final enzymes in cortisol synthesis that serve as branch points for steroid synthesis? Number 17, number 21, and number 11. Specifically, 17 alpha hydroxylase, 21 hydroxylase, and 11 beta hydroxylase. But most important is for you to remember the order 17, 21, and 11. If you have number 17, you can make cortisol and the androgens. If not, you can only make aldosterone. If you have number 21, you can make cortisol and aldosterone. If not, you can only make androgens. And if you have number 11, like with 21, you can make cortisol and aldosterone. If not, you can make androgens and weak mineralocorticoids. Part 2. How does a patient with congenital adrenal hyperplasia present? As you might expect, the effects of a deficiency in steroid synthesis differs based on which enzyme is deficient. You get low levels of the steroid the enzyme is required for, but high levels of the steroids that you can synthesize because of the adrenal hyperplasia that's induced by high levels of ACTH. Even more confusing, most of the time a loss of function mutation doesn't usually mean no function at all. And based on the specific enzyme mutation, the range of symptoms experienced by a given patient may vary from mild disease presenting in adolescence to severe disease presenting at birth. That's what we call variable penetrance for you genetics nerds. But there are some common clinical patterns that can be seen. Surprisingly, the size of the adrenals is not what usually leads to the diagnosis. While the adrenals are enlarged, it's most often the other symptoms that lead to more investigation. Since CAH always involves cortisol deficiency to a greater or lesser extent, let's go over those symptoms first, since you'll see them in most of your patients. First, patients with severe enzyme loss of function often present in the first month of life with failure to thrive and poor feeding, much like patients with Addison's disease, who often present with weight loss and loss of appetite. And these presenting symptoms are usually secondary to cortisol deficiency. Second, hypoglycemia and hypotension can also result from decreased levels of cortisol, though hypotension is exacerbated if the levels of aldosterone are simultaneously low. In addition to exacerbating hypotension, if aldosterone deficiencies are severe enough, it can also lead to some pretty serious physiologic consequences revolving around the inability to retain salt and water. In addition to dehydration, hyponatremia, and hypotension, the other major consequence to be concerned about is hyperkalemia, since aldosterone causes sodium to be exchanged for potassium in the distal and collecting tubules. And the reason this is so consequential is because of the potential to cause abrupt and potentially lethal arrhythmias. Like I mentioned, the reason you get hyperplasia of the adrenal glands is because low cortisol causes a compensatory increase in ACTH. Like with Addison's disease, a severe enough cortisol deficiency can lead to hyperpigmentation, since ACTH is synthesized from the same precursor as melanotropin-stimulating hormone. But there's another consequence to the hyperplasia. In addition to bringing the levels of cortisol closer to normal, this also abnormally increases steroid production along the pathways that are still functioning. In patients whose enzyme deficiency spares the mineralocorticoids, you frequently see hypertension and hypokalemia. Additionally, while underproduction of the weak androgens isn't a huge deal, overproduction of the weak androgens can definitely cause symptoms of virilization in females and precocious puberty in boys. Development of the male urogenital system depends on the presence of androgens, so actually, these disorders are not usually detected in males at birth. The presence of strong androgens and excessive presence of weak androgens both drive the urogenital system to develop as male. Males may, however, show symptoms when boys undergo early signs of puberty. In females, depending on the severity of the disease, they can present at birth with an entire spectrum of ambiguous genitalia, ranging from clitoromegaly to fusion of the labioscrotal folds to abnormal positioning of the urethra. There may be early growth of pubic hair or accelerated bone growth. More minor forms may present later in life with irregular menses, infertility, and hirsutism. But in all cases, there's the additional psychosocial issue of gender dysphoria that med students don't usually discuss, but it is absolutely significant to patients and their families. Part 3. What causes CAH? Like I mentioned earlier, congenital adrenal hyperplasia is an autosomal recessive disorder, and these mutations lead to deficiencies of specific steroid hormone synthesizing enzymes. Again, the three enzyme deficiencies you need to know are the three branch points in cortisol synthesis, 17 alpha, 21, and 11 beta hydroxylase deficiencies. But the most common cause, by like a huge margin, as in 90% of the cases, is 21 hydroxylase deficiency. Next is 11 beta hydroxylase deficiency. And third is 17 alpha hydroxylase deficiency. Part 4. How do we diagnose CAH? In this section, I'm going to focus on differentiating the three main types of CAH by their clinical presentation and by their characteristic lab findings. Because understanding how the enzyme deficiencies result in abnormal levels of different steroids and predicting how that will manifest physiologically is conceptually the most important. And from the previous sections, you actually already have the tools you need. So buckle up, gang. It's time to put them to the test. Now, remind me what the most common enzyme deficiency in CAH is. 21 hydroxylase deficiency, right. Now think back to your branch points in steroid synthesis. If 21 hydroxylase is present, what can you make? Aldosterone and cortisol, right? Since 21 hydroxylase is involved in the synthesis of both. But if number 21 is not present, then you can only make adrenal androgens. So bottom line, 21 hydroxylase deficiency, the most common type of CAH, is characterized by a deficiency in aldosterone and cortisol. Because remember, these mutations involve a loss of enzyme function, not no function at all. The next question is, if androgen synthesis is still intact, will these patients have elevated, reduced, or normal levels of androgens? Elevated, because the increased ACTH in response to low cortisol results in upregulation of weak androgen production. Now, time to put this all together, guys. If a patient with 21 hydroxylase deficiency can be expected to have decreased aldosterone, decreased cortisol, and elevated weak androgens, then what signs and symptoms might the patient present with? The low cortisol can lead to hypoglycemia. Low aldosterone can lead to dehydration, hyponatremia, and hyperkalemia. And the combination of the two can lead to hypotension. And these all sound like catastrophic consequences, but the degree of enzyme deficiency varies a lot. The general rule is, the more severe the loss of function, the earlier the patients develop symptoms. Patients with severe deficiencies will often present in infancy with failure to thrive, and labs can show some pretty crazy electrolyte abnormalities, or even what's known as an adrenal crisis. Initial management for patients in adrenal crisis includes intravenous fluid resuscitation with sodium-containing fluids, electrolyte regulation, and cortisol and, if needed, mineralocorticoid administration. Now, let's address that androgen situation. Less emergent, but conceptually important. We mentioned that an excess of weak androgens usually affects females much more than males, though both sexes can actually experience early puberty and short stature, because the growth plates fuse sooner. But since an excess of weak androgens isn't nearly as potent as a normal level of testosterone, an excess of weak androgens is a pretty minor change overall for boys. Girls, on the other hand, can experience a range of findings from infertility to hirsutism to menstrual problems. And since androgens control the development of the male external reproductive tract in utero, severe enzyme deficiencies in females present at birth with ambiguous genitalia. Since even an excess of weak androgens isn't enough to cause the reproductive tract to develop as fully male, the genitals are termed as ambiguous. The abnormality can range from an enlarged clitoris, to fusion of the labioscrotal folds, to a male-type urethra that comes out through the clitoris rather than beneath it. But importantly, it's only the external genitals that are affected. These patients still have normal ovaries and a normal uterus. Now, in the developed world, you don't normally diagnose this when children come into the emergency department in adrenal crisis. Newborn screening for 17-hydroxyprogesterone is measured in all newborns in the U.S. as a screen for 21-hydroxylase deficiency, and an elevated level suggests that a downstream enzyme like 21-hydroxylase isn't working properly, causing a buildup of reactants. If the newborn screen is inconclusive, you can use ACTH stimulation testing. And this measures the level of cortisol in the patient's blood before and after the administration of a synthetic ACTH known as cosentropin. If the adrenals are working properly, the cortisol should rise. If the response to the ACTH administration is inadequate, well, this points to a diagnosis of CAH. Next, let's cover 11 beta hydroxylase deficiency, and we'll start this off like the last one. If 11 beta hydroxylase is present, what can you make? Aldosterone and cortisol, just like with number 21. And since that enzyme is downstream from number 21, you might think that an 11 beta hydroxylase deficiency should look pretty much like a 21 hydroxylase deficiency, with reduced cortisol and aldosterone and increased androgens. But remember, the cortisol and aldosterone precursors, most importantly 11-deoxycorticosterone, act like mineralocorticoids. So, if these patients will have an excess of mineralocorticoids and androgens, but a cortisol deficiency, what clinical manifestations do you suspect? The excess androgens can cause virilization and sexual dysfunction in females, and early puberty and infusion of the growth plates in both sexes, just like with number 21. But the excess of mineralocorticoids will tend to cause both hypertension and hypokalemia, instead of hypotension and hyperkalemia. It's important to note that the hypertension tends to occur in adults, who are more predisposed to that anyway, and that infants can and do present in adrenal crisis. Finally, let's tackle the third most common form of CAH, 17-alpha-hydroxylase deficiency. You know the drill, gang. If 17-alpha-hydroxylase is missing, then what steroids can you not make? Number 17 is our first branch point, remember? So if you don't have 17-alpha-hydroxylase, then you can't make either cortisol or androgens, but you will make a ton of aldosterone. Symptoms of high aldosterone are similar to those of an 11-beta-hydroxylase deficiency, hypertension, and hypokalemia. With the androgen deficiency, you have to remember that both testosterone and estrogen are synthesized from the weak androgens. At birth, female will have normal genitalia, since female genitalia are essentially the fetus's default setting and don't require any hormone input. Males, on the other hand, now they may have ambiguous genitalia, since the weak androgens provide the raw materials for the testosterone that usually drives male genital development in utero. Here, both male and female puberty is affected, because the decreased synthesis of weak androgens mean that both testosterone and estrogen will be decreased as well. At the normal time of puberty, females may experience amenorrhea and infertility, while males often experience impaired development of sperm. Both female and male secondary sex characteristic development, like breast and penis enlargement and pubic hair, are generally decreased. Now, if you check out the brick on congenital adrenal hyperplasia, Table 2 summarizes the three types of CAH, as well as their associated hormonal abnormalities. Part 5. How do we treat CAH? Since all patients with CAH are, by definition, deficient in cortisol, glucocorticoid replacement is required. At birth, if the patient is presenting with adrenal crisis, they need rapid treatment with high-dose IV glucocorticoids, as well as IV fluids. Once they're stable, then you can focus on replacing the deficient hormones, not only to correct the deficiency, but also to reduce the high adrenal androgen production, at least in 21-hydroxylase and 11-beta-hydroxylase deficiency. Patients with 21-hydroxylase deficiency may also require replacement with mineralocorticoids, like fludrocortisone. Treatment of patients with 11-beta-hydroxylase and 17-alpha-hydroxylase deficiency may involve management of hypertension and hypokalemia with antihypertensives and potassium supplementation, though this is usually a little bit later in life. Additionally, for patients with 17-alpha-hydroxylase deficiency, management generally involves hormonal supplementation at puberty to ensure appropriate development of secondary sex characteristics. Females receive estrogen and progestins, and males receive testosterone. Now, in all cases where ambiguous genitalia are present at birth, a serious conversation needs to be had with the family about the appropriateness and timing of surgical normalization of genital atypia. Now, this is a huge topic unto itself that involves medical ethics, gender identity, and psychosocial development that is really not in the scope of what we're discussing today. But suffice to say, it's a big deal for parents, and eventually, the patients. Regardless, the presence of ambiguous genitalia at birth should immediately be assumed to represent CAH pending confirmatory testing, because the consequence of not treating it as such is potential adrenal crisis. Let's end this section with a pop quiz question. What is the best initial management for patients with 21-hydroxylase deficiency and symptoms of dehydration and hypotension? Since this clinical presentation indicates adrenal crisis, hydrocortisone, IV, and normal saline are administered in all patients. Fludrocortisone can also be administered based on the patient's sodium and potassium levels and what they indicate about mineralocorticoid deficiency. And that's a wrap. Let's see what you learned about the wild, wild world of steroids here on AudioBricks. First, what deficiency is common to all forms of congenital adrenal hyperplasia? All forms of congenital adrenal hyperplasia are caused by enzyme deficiencies that result in decreased synthesis of cortisol. This leads to high ACTH secretion as a way for the body to compensate, which is what causes the adrenal hyperplasia. Second, what are common clinical presentations of cortisol deficiency found in most patients with CAH? Symptoms of cortisol deficiency include hypotension and hypoglycemia. In infants with severe deficiencies, CAH can also manifest as failure to thrive or even adrenal crisis with shock and life-threatening hypoglycemia. Third, what is the most common form of congenital adrenal hyperplasia, and how would you expect the levels of aldosterone and androgens to change? The most common form of CAH is 21-hydroxylase deficiency, and this results in low levels of aldosterone, leading to dehydration and hyperkalemia, and high levels of androgens, leading to virilization in females, and early puberty and short stature in both sexes. Finally, how do you expect levels of aldosterone and androgens to change in patients with 11-beta and 17-alpha-hydroxylase deficiencies? Beta-hydroxylase deficiency leads to increased androgens, like 21-hydroxylase deficiency, and elevated mineralocorticoids, leading to hypertension and hypokalemia. 17-alpha-hydroxylase deficiency leads to increased mineralocorticoids, but decreased androgens. This results in ambiguous genitalia in males, and leads to decreased testosterone and estrogen synthesis that results in decreased secondary sex characteristics and infertility that only become apparent at puberty. Now, armed with your newfound knowledge, let's get back to that patient from the intro. A 2-week-old female infant presents for a routine visit with clinical evidence of dehydration and failure to thrive, and on physical exam appears to have ambiguous genitalia. What congenital disorder might explain the patient's presentation? And how does this affect your initial management? While there are a number of disorders that can cause dehydration and failure to thrive in infancy, the ambiguous genitalia immediately makes you consider congenital adrenal hyperplasia, specifically the most common form caused by a deficiency in 21-hydroxylase. But the pediatric hospital is an hour away, and you realize that if the patient is actually in adrenal crisis, you don't have time to wait for confirmatory lab testing before you begin treatment. So while calling an ambulance, your nurse starts an IV. You administer a bolus of IV normal saline and a dose of IV hydrocortisone. The child's heart rate normalizes, and by the time the ambulance arrives, she appears somewhat more alert. You know you're eventually going to have a number of important discussions with the patient's parents ahead, but for now, you've addressed the child's most life-threatening concerns. And that's our show. If you like what you heard, make sure to like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. Remember, your feedback helps us improve. You can enjoy the full Bricks experience online at www.usmle-rx.com, complete with illustrations, questions, flashcards, and active learning. So go check that out if you haven't already. Until next time, friends.